This is a download from the BBC. For our terms and conditions, go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts. I'm Tom Service. Welcome to the Music Matters podcast. Conductor Christopher Hogwood is 70 this year. He's just turned 70 last week. A strange thought that a musician and scholar who's still at the sharpest cutting edge of early music and historically informed performance should be a septuagenarian. Happens to us all, I guess. But from his game-changing recordings of Mozart and Beethoven symphonies, of Haydn and Handel, and latterly a repertoire that includes Martinu as well as Monteverdi, Christopher Hogwood has changed what the musical world thought it knew about the past. We've been hearing Hogwood's performances in Essential Classics all this week here on BBC Radio 3 weekday mornings, but it all began in terms of Hogwood's recordings thanks to the producer Peter Wadland, who sponsored many of Hogwood's early recordings in the 1980s with the period instrument band the Academy of Ancient Music, including those stripped down, elegant and energetic performances of Mozart and Beethoven. Well, that was then, this is now. Given that Chris Hogwood is now working with modern instrument orchestras and that no self-respecting young conductor, no self-respecting young von Bülow wannabe, would choose not to learn from Hogwood's example, I asked Christopher Hogwood, had he won the battle for the soul of how to play Baroque and classical repertoire? Was the campaign over?
Well, I guess it's a campaign as it looked at the start, rather like the campaign for Real Ale, that once Real Ale is available in the pubs, the campaign was essentially over, until somebody pointed out that the problem now was the pubs were closing, and so you had to have a campaign to save the outlet of what you had been trying to support. So no, I don't think it's completely over, because I do think as finance gets stricter and stricter, one has to make sure that live concerts continue, and this does mean serious live concerts performed by the right people in what we would now consider the right way, which might not be exactly the same as it once was. So there is a developing need, I think, to make sure that one doesn't sit back and become complacent.
The musicology work has been done. We know what we're doing. Therefore, we don't need to think about it anymore. We can just get on and play. You think that's a potential complacency?
Well, I think it is a danger that comes with regularity of work, that when we started, the work wasn't very regular. The opportunities for using a sort of laboratory setup were very many more than now, because thanks to the BBC, thanks to record companies, you could actually earn as you learnt, and you could put together an exact team for a project and then find what the scientific fallout was. It was a perfect laboratory environment, and they were, I think, extremely tolerant of us, and they aren't often thanked enough, especially when recordings have gone downhill in quantity and when the BBC is not supporting as many studio activities as it once did.
It is amazing, actually, just reading back some phenomena in the history of your history of recording and your work with the BBC, like the idea that the Academy of Ancient Music essentially was got off the ground through a producer saying, well, look, we should do all of Mozart's symphonies. The BBC, you presented a 13-part series on the Trio Sonata, things that probably wouldn't happen now in the same way.
I think they wouldn't. I think they were perhaps given so much rope to hang themselves with in those days, that the start was not actually the Mozart symphonies, although that was terrific for putting AAM on the map in what people called serious repertoire instead of, you know, Stone Age music. But the vision of Decca, for instance, was not specifically one group, one period in music, because at the same time that Peter Wadland said, why don't we put together a Baroque orchestra modelled on what we'd seen Harnenko and Leonhardt doing, he also took on board the Consort of Music to cover the 17th century and 16th century, and took on the Music Party with Alan Hacker to cover the 19th century. So it was a very comprehensive view of what one or two people thought a record company at its peak should be doing to support this sort of activity. So we were one of several beneficiaries that got this service, ditto the BBC.
what's the relationship then between what you've described as experiments or laboratories and performance? When you listen to those recordings, which you made in under laboratory conditions, are they simply experiments or do they speak as performances too?
I use laboratory in the sense that you could put together for a particular project exactly what was needed, the right expert, the right text, the right number of players, which you couldn't do in a context that I would call normal concert life. It would be too expensive and you would need something else in the same programme. So it was laboratory in the sense that it was focused on one particular project. The performance was a performance, like all others. When you're there and playing or singing, you're not thinking, am I right? Historically, you know, did the textbook say this? You're giving a performance that you believe in probably more than you would if you were being told by a director to perform in a style you found slightly suspect for the material.
It sounds to me, though, that there are degrees of rightness, because if you want to have like the right instruments, the potentially the right context, and the right approach to the musical material, whether it's a Beethoven symphony, a Mozart symphony, Haydn, Monteverdi, whatever, and yet then the performance is something different. It's where those conditions of rightness disappear. I mean, aren't you sort of having it both ways? Because you would say, surely, that your performances are more right from the kick-off than a performance that isn't as researched, that hasn't got the essential conditions right.
I don't think it's right and wrong. I love a lot of performances which I can openly say to be completely wrong. I think Horowitz playing Scarlatti on the Steinway is fantastic, and I would listen to it with great musical pleasure. So there's a difference. There's historically motivated or historically aware, which are quite different things, I think, from being what we used to call authentic. I think authentic doesn't do much specifically for early music now, other than remind you that all performers, when they get up and perform, jolly well have to believe in what they're doing. If I got up and was involved in a performance of a Bach keyboard concerto involving a grand piano, although one could make something very beautiful and musical of it, and I would quite enjoy it, I don't think I would enjoy it as much or feel there was as much of me being called for in it as if in my prior preparation for this activity I had eliminated some things as being unsuitable in my eyes and other things being more suitable. So right to me, I think it is, you know, it's just assembling the ingredients for you. All you have is this cookbook recipe, which is sometimes a bit skimpily notated, and it's your job to put in what you consider to be the chef's intentions for both the ingredients and the process, and what comes out will be a souffle and not an omelette unless you got it wrong.
You once said that there are no mysteries left, that it's hard for a young performer to do something that hasn't been done before, either by you or one of your many esteemed colleagues. Is that still true, do you think, that if you're a young musician, it's hard to find that sense of mystery, that sense of a new place to go?
Well, everybody wants to do something original and be noted for it. It's no point in going to us olders and saying, tell me what is original and new now, because if we knew, we'd be doing it. I think in the context in which I felt that was, a lot of this repertoire has been now turned over for the first time. So you can no longer be the first person to play a Mozart symphony on a historical instrument. You can no longer be the first person to play Bach on a harpsichord. There are lots of things in the 19th century that nobody has thought to look into too deeply. And, you know, I would advise people to look there. The wave of interest that we were involved in tended to start with Purcell and move forwards. There's quite a strong argument, I think, for asking people to look backwards a little bit and have a look at Marini, have a look at the Italian trio sonata, have a look at French music. I mean, nobody has really got to the bottom of Muffat and Lully and the French composers of an ensemble totally different from the ones we have usually built up for playing their music. I'm just in the middle of trying to put together a new edition of Corelli violin sonatas for Bärenreiter, which will include not only a wide slew of all the embellishments that different players noted for adding to his music, but also will include an original keyboard realisation from the early 18th century in a style that you will never, ever hear anybody. Very thick, full, I think, terrific in small doses. I'm not sure I could stand it forever and ever. But it is very symptomatic of the fact that we have adopted a very nice, pleasant, ornamental, schoolroom, you know, faultless style of accompaniment on keyboards. Bears very little relation to the Gasparini and the Tonelli and people like that, which is the living evidence of what was expected at Corelli's time.
It sounds to me basically like what you want to happen is to keep up from everyone, musicians, musicologists, people who are doing both, that endless sense of questioning, and that whenever you find something you think you know, you almost certainly don't.
Yes, never. It's like writing a piece of literature, you know, when you write your review or your essay or your chapter of the book, and every good critic says immediately, lift out all those bits you are most fond of and throw them away, query the logic behind every conjunction. Despite Mozart doing this, nevertheless, something else happened. And a good critic comes along and says, wait a minute, is there any evidence of the despite and nevertheless? Is it not just two disassociated facts that it's your job to connect, or else not to use them in conjunction? So I think almost everything can be pulled apart. Yes, you can query every note, every player, every item in even one Brandenburg concerto, let alone six Brandenburg concertos, let alone 100 more Telemann concertos and others that contribute to the context in which one sees this music.
So it's still all there to be discovered. Even maybe the terra cognita, supposedly, is still there to be discovered and continually rediscovered.
I think the questions are there to be asked. They're to be asked of standard repertoire, and they are even more important to be asked by those people who have got a little bit weary of playing the standard repertoire and want to go outside it, because they'll find friends out there in the public who are really sick and tired of hearing the same stuff over and over again, sounding approximately authentic, but they knew it all for the last 30 years. They would like something that actually, you know, made their ears stick up and they heard something new or as for the first time.
Christopher Hogwood, still a pretty good manifesto for music making, that. Thank you for listening to this download from the BBC. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts.